Welcome to Women in Venture Capital. I'm Rushvina, Chief of Staff at General Catalyst, with prior experience in finance and early stage VC.
And I'm Anvita, Senior Product Manager at UiPath with experiences across tech startups and venture capital. Our mission at Women in Venture Capital is simple: increase the representation of women in the VC industry through awareness and engagement.
So join us as we engage with women establishing their presence in the industry.
Our guest today is Ash Arora. Ash is the youngest partner at Local Globe, a leading early stage venture capital fund in Europe. There are investors in Twitter, Figma, Robinhood, TransferWise, Canva, etc. She has a diverse background in strategy, finance, and technology. Ash's interest in investing began when she invested her Christmas bonus in cryptocurrencies in 2017, marking her entry into the world of blockchain. More on that in our chat. Before Local Globe, Ash worked at Citigroup at in sales and trading, and with the Prime Minister's office in India, where she worked on strategy and policy, along with making emerging tech startup investments. She then transitioned to Polygon Labs, a top 10 blockchain technology firm. Thank you so much for joining us today, Ash. It's a pleasure to have you.
Thank you so much for having me, Anvita. Always happy to chat with you.
Lovely. So jumping right in, share with us your career experiences that helped you land Local Globe as one of their youngest partners. Would love to also hear about your foray into the world of blockchain.
Absolutely. So, it's so funny. I am so obsessed with the fund that I work for, Local Globe, and everyone in my team. It's not just one of those things that, you know, a year after working with an organization, you start thinking they are just absolutely incredible and I can't sort of say bad things about them. It's actually true. It's literally the best job I've ever had, and incredible mentors, incredible talent, yet so humble. So I feel very fortunate to actually be working with them. I found them through a headhunter. So it's ironic that I did not know of them before actually sort of starting to interview with them, because I was working with headhunters. I was looking at so many different geographies, so many different types of funds, both Web3 as well as Web2, trying to figure out what would be the next big step for me. I didn't want a job where I'm going there for like a year or 2 years and just kind of using it as a stepping stone. I wanted a place where I can literally be a part of the team, join at a level where I feel comfortable, yet have an opportunity to grow and learn from people who are definitely more senior to me, with definitely more decades of experience in investing. So how I landed here was, again, through a headhunter. One of the headhunters that actually I was working with, I had hired for Polygon to help recruit for my team. And it just happened that they were recruiting for so many investors. And I started thinking, because at Polygon, I absolutely loved my time there as well. I was learning so much and I was doing so much. But one thing I really missed was working with founders. As an investor, one of the best feelings is working with founders, talented people, learning from them over a period of time. Not necessarily just sitting on their boards, but just like watching them grow and watching them overcome the challenges that they face and learning from that experience. And we were not able to do that because of just the organizational structure. So when this headhunter mentioned Local Globe is recruiting, and along with a bunch of other funds, I was interested to maybe speak to them, see how they operate. I'd never been at a traditional VC fund before that. So yeah, it was just an opportunity for me. And yeah, like here we are today. At Polygon, I was hired to help with the $500 million fundraise that we did, and spun $100 million fund out and deployed it in early stage Web3 companies globally. The fund is stellar. The team that we ended up recruiting is also beyond stellar. We had several unicorns. We ended up backing 4 unicorns fairly early in the Web3 space, majority of them being in the US. And it just kind of got me so peaked in like the global venture market as to like, unicorn status is one thing, but sort of working with those kind of talented people, working with those kind of talented co-investors, because we were not leading, we were co-investing. So we were working more closely with investors than founders. It was just an entire experience, and the network that I ended up sort of creating was life-changing. And I'm learning so much from not just founders, but also from my peers. So it's been a hell of a journey. Before that, I was a banker. Like you said, I've worked with the government. I've basically put on a bunch of hats. So at this point, I call myself like a jack of all trades, definitely master of none. It's definitely an experience that I never expected to end up in VC. I always thought I'll be a banker or maybe I'll work with the government, given I have very strong political inclinations in general, and way too many political opinions globally. But I ended up just being obsessed with the impact that tech creates. So I was working in a nonprofit with the government, and I realized the sister organization that we had been doing this for like over a decade. And I realized one thing, which was they had not created as much impact in education in India that Google had. So that was like a very pivotal moment for me where I felt that tech has actually created more impact. And policy and politics and government and nonprofit, all of these things were like I was obsessed with because I wanted to create impact at scale. And it just happened so that I came across tech companies that were doing that. And yeah, it was, I think at that point, it was inevitable for me to end up in VC.
That's amazing. I think the one takeaway definitely is though that you should just be strategic about your moves. Like, just know what you want to do and then find ways to get to it. Like you said, you worked with a few headhunters and you were strategic enough to kind of rope in somebody who you had hired as part of your earlier venture. And then when you landed Local Globe, you're like super happy with the team. You were able to do your diligence in time. I think that's an incredible, I would say, takeaway on how you want to move and do transitions within your career. Before I ask my next one, I'm curious if you can double down on how you forayed into blockchain, because somewhere I read on how surreal that was, where you in 2017 decided to spend some of your Christmas bonus into blockchain. How was what went about at that point?
Absolutely. I have to say, very stellar stalking skills because this is not very publicly known or written. So well done. I got into the space because I was at Citi. So, you know, I was the youngest on the floor. I was in a sort of market. I was youngest on the floor in Bombay in India. And my team was looking at the second bull run of Bitcoin. This is back in 2017. And my MD looks at me and goes, you know, you're young, you like these new things. Why don't you do a research project on Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies and tell us what's going on and whether it makes sense for like Citi to do anything there? When I started on it, it was just like a side project, like a small side project, one of like 10. But then eventually became a thing where the Asia markets head also was very interested in looking at cryptocurrencies from an India lens, given India was the second largest revenue-making market for Citibank globally in markets. So it was a big market. It was a big opportunity for us to go deeper here before our other competitors. Yeah, I spent over 3 months going extremely deep. Back in the day, if you Googled cryptocurrency, the first 10 links would basically be this scam and that fraud and that money laundering. You couldn't really kind of learn much. So you have to go really deep. So I was deep into like 4chan chats, which I don't think anyone even who entered crypto in the last few years even knows of. And Reddit threads, where we were kind of exchanging links and opportunities and creating like material to help each other learn and understand the space. Majority were developers, there were very few traders. So, like, all us sort of traders from back in the day are still very much in touch. We have like so many groups and communities still. So, yeah, I went very deep. After 3 months, I made like this 113 slide deck, which I presented properly to like every senior, and they basically threw it out the window. They said this is too speculative and unregulated. We can't do anything with it from a Citibank lens. But then for those 3 months, because I'm a chatty person and I am always like telling my family to do this or like my friends to like, you know, give them like these kind of alpha things. I'd been talking about cryptocurrencies and I'd been talking specifically about Ethereum actually, more than even Bitcoin. And I was begging everyone in my life to buy Bitcoin, Ethereum, and a bunch of other shitcoins, which I'm not gonna name. But yeah, my friends and family were like, no, this is all scam. Like, yeah, we lose money. So when this happened, I got my Christmas bonus a month later, and I was told, because I was in markets, it was my first 6 months still, I was told I can't invest in capital markets because, you know, like there's a Chinese wall there. So, and compliance reasons. So I was told I can basically do a fixed deposit in India, or I could do real estate. Now, the amount was not enough to buy real estate, obviously. So I ended up, my parents are like, yeah, of course, do an FD, right? Like, yeah, like make whatever 6-7% return that you make on an annual basis. And I was like, no, that's boring. I was looking at other opportunities, and my friends go, I remember you have been talking about crypto for so long. You should put your money where your mouth is. So why don't you invest in your cryptocurrencies? And that's exactly what I did. And in 4 months, my portfolio 6X'd. And that's when I lost it. I'm like, how's this even possible? And I think it was a trader mentality that made me think, hey, I can't exit because there's something here. I need to understand the macroeconomic space here and do a deeper dive on the financial sort of sector. That's what I did. And I ended up starting my own crypto prop trading firm on the side with a couple of friends. And we started with doing strategic arbitrage. We ended up doing LSTM trading, which is long short-term memory. So that's like algorithmic trading on cryptocurrencies. And yeah, we learned a lot along the way. We sort of also started angel investing on the side in both Web2 and Web3 startups. So it was, yeah, a monumental experience for me that I would definitely never forget. The angel network is still very active. It's called Fund of Friends. There's a website as well. We can plug that in. And the crypto prop trading firm we had to close because of lack of regulatory clarity in India. So we never really kind of were able to scale it up. But then I think eventually all of us wanted to work in blockchain full time. And yeah, all of us now are working in blockchain in some way or the other full time. So that's how I entered the space.
I love it. I think it's like the right person at the right time.
Yeah.
Good for you, I think,
Just
and good
not if it
for
was luck. Yes.
that's amazing. Yeah, I think that's really cool. For what you said about the stalking skills, I have to admit there was a lot of ChatGPT and Perplexity, so I have to give them a little bit of credit, and they did good. I didn't realize it wasn't as public, but I'm glad it came out and our listeners get to listen to
Yeah, shout out for Perplexity as well. We should do. Arvind would be happy.
that. I agree. Cool. Thanks for sharing that. Switching gears a little, you spoke about how you've worked a lot in blockchain. I know you're now working in GenAI as well. Let's talk a little bit about that because that's all over the news and all over the place for the right reasons. So, what are your thoughts on the current growing trend in GenAI, and how do you see the space evolving in the future, and how does that impact your line of investing?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think that's a very loaded question. This is the same question that I was asked on blockchain back in 21. And the answer was things are happening every week. So by the time this this podcast is actually published, the answer could be different. But yeah, so I'm spending a lot of time. So I used to do a lot of data analytics back in the day as well. So I had a very rudimentary understanding of ML. And since sort of this entire wave of AI has come out since 22, I spent a lot of time because blockchain was sort of not as active. So I've spent a lot of time looking at AI, ML in general. And there's so many different impact, sort of impact areas that can be disrupted because of AI. So I think the way I am looking at it is there's like a data side, then there's a distribution side, and then there's a workflow side, and then there is this entire hardware and infrastructure piece. So like these would be like sort of the tech stack ranking, both horizontal as well as vertically, the way we are evaluating the space. So there's so much happening. I mean, Perplexity is one of the best examples we can think of in like a crossover of workflow with middleware. So like indexing the entire World Wide Web is exceptionally useful and not noisy. And there's no longer the, you know, the top 10 blue links and the noise that creates and the ad revenue, et cetera, that comes out of it. So Perplexity is exceptionally useful. There are so many other businesses that we are seeing across this entire space. I am personally excited very much about vertical AI as well as middleware. So there's, you know, sort of lots of companies that are working on RLHF, RLAIF. And kind of improving the efficiency of fine-tuning existing LLMs to make them specific for enterprise use, to make them specific for sectoral use, like Hippocratic AI is one of them for health, so on and so forth. So I think those are areas that are very personally exciting for me. Another would be open source AI. So we just recently done Hugging Face. In the last round. So it's again something that I feel is bringing about these communities together that are able to then create value. So it's like the WhatsApp moment, right? Where there's no monetization as such directly from the get-go, but there are people who are coming together and the distribution mode becomes so sort of, you know, compelling that you know that eventually this is going to be a massively used business. So that is what I feel like. Hugging Face is basically GitHub for AI. So very obsessed with that. We've also done Mistral at seed last year. So that's again at a very fundamental level, we were trying to make LLMs more usable with less compute, more scalable. So that just kind of checked all the right boxes. And like I said, vertical AI, which is also very interesting, where I feel that lots of specific sectoral functional expertise that is needed across organizations and like workflow automation could also have massive impacts on productivity. So like there's this very famous chart, which I'm sure you've seen, which is the sort of headcount needed to get to 1 million revenue for S&P 500 companies. So that average went down from 7 to 1 in the last like 25 or 27 years. Like this data compares 1990 to 2020, I think, something of that sort. So the number now, I think the scale that I'm obsessed with is the number of headcount needed to get to 10 million in revenue. And that number could be one or below. It could be a fractional number. So that is where I think AI plays a very big role, which is why future of work in general, as an overarching thesis, has become exceptionally interesting for all of us. And I'm spending a lot of time in future of work, in AI, a little bit in health as well. And of course, blockchain still remains my bread and butter.
That's amazing. Those are some really cool logos you have there under your umbrella. So that's really nice. You ended up your answer with talking about blockchain, saying that is your bread and butter. Would love to talk a little bit more about that. You have spent most of your time there. What role do you think policymaking and regulations would play in this sector's progression? You touched a little bit about this in your previous answers and how that initially came within your way to maybe progress on different aspects, but how do you think that will eventually open up this space or for any reason close it out?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's a very good day to be asking this question, given SBF was jailed for 25 years today. So I think
No, no.
there are two sides to this, right? So there is regulation and then there is policy. The regulatory piece for me is the regulation is something that should always be post facto, and there should be a regulatory framework which is under the guise of a policy that exists, which helps people understand what is the direction they need to take. I have massive respect for the Finance Minister of India, as well as the entire working committee of blockchain. But it is true that when someone like me was doing crypto trading in India, there was no regulatory or policy clarity, which is why we had to shut shop because they said, hey, you are doing this and you're paying this much taxes. That's not okay. And then my question was, then what is okay? And the answer is, we don't know. Right? So, like, basically doing regulation or like doing regulatory activities by prosecution is something that crypto has started facing. And policymaking shouldn't be a part of that. So regulation such as that, prosecution should be post facto and policy should be pre facto instead of going after people who've done nothing wrong and then trying to tell them that, hey, that's wrong. So that is something that I think the space doesn't do. So if I specifically talk about, let's say the US market right now for blockchain, where the regulatory environment is very, very, for the lack of a better word, bearish. There's obviously a lot of political sort of levers that are involved here. And it is tricky for any builder to know exactly what are the limitations in the space that they're supposed to adhere to right now. And that's why, there's like this internal industry joke that the only people who've made money from crypto are lawyers. That's because every single new founder would raise and would hire this sort of fancy law firm and would basically be like, okay, now tell me what all am I allowed to do and what are the boundaries that I'm allowed to operate in. So that is not, that in my opinion stifles early stage innovation. So it's important to create like a, some sort of a sandbox where innovation can thrive, which historically California has always been. Since I don't even know when, probably like 70s, 80s, since like Vinod Khosla went to Stanford and like his origin story, Juniper Network. So I think it's important to remember that that is something that a lot of geographies still need. And I feel that the EU regulation specifically is a very big step in the right direction. I've looked at all the policy drafts of the UK, of the EU, of California, as well as the US. Whatever has been released by CFTC publicly. And I feel that the EU regulatory environment that exists around blockchain sort of hamstrings those people who are trying to do fraudulent things with blockchain, but doesn't eliminate the level of innovation that is needed for disruption and truly changing the world. So, very bullish on EU regulation in general. And additionally, I would also say that the working policy framework that is required should be very comprehensive. If you are talking about end use case impact, let's say decentralized finance and DeFi, which is what we call it, you don't want them to replace banks. You have to go a step below and give them specific instructions that, okay, these are the financial volume limits on a daily basis you can't breach. This is the kind of infrastructure. If you're using this, it needs to have this level of security. It needs to have this level of geographic siloing or like sort of expansion, so on and so forth. Like specific instructions is something that at a policy level are needed. And I know that the EU and both the US are working by sp like hardly are working hard on it. But at the same time, I don't think we are there yet. So that will be very interesting. The way Tim Berners-Lee, the founder of, the father of the World Wide Web, defines it, he says that the space should basically be open for anyone to kind of come and innovate. And blockchain is the only actually industry where we have to think about policy before we start building. So it's gonna result in a lot of impediments for founders who are building in the space, but hopefully investors like me are still gonna be around and help them out as much as we can, given our, both policy and investing and tech and blockchain lens.
I love it. I think this is super comprehensive and clearly well researched, and it definitely shows how much you've gone into depth into the space. So that's amazing. Taking a step back from a broader investing perspective, your time at Local Globe and how you're doing early stage investing, talk a little bit to us on how you approach those early stage conversations and build your founder network to get the founders' attention.
That's a very good question. And that's a question I don't think I'll be able to answer even in 20 years properly, because I think it's the way we say it, right? Like your degree is the beginning of your education, not the end. So I think the day you become a VC, that's the beginning of you building your network, your presence, your learning, your understanding of the space, so that the right kind of founders would want to work with you, as opposed to you chasing after them and being like, work with me, please. So I think the way I look at early stage investing is I have this mental framework of FPBM, which is founder, product, business model, market. That's how I evaluate any new opportunity. So at a founder level, obviously under each of these verticals, I won't bore you to death. I have like 10 to 20 questions and parameters that I evaluate under each, and try to be as analytical as possible instead of, just sort of doing it at a surface level that, hey, this is a friend of a friend, I should invest. So I think the way I evaluate the TLDR on the founder would be, would I grab a drink with this person? Like on a regular basis. It's as simple as that. Do I think that they're intelligent? Do I think that they know what they are doing? Do I think that they are visionary? Do I think that they are affable? They are amicable? They are easy to get along with? Do I think that they are somebody who can attract talent? Like so on and so forth. Like, are they someone who I love to be in the presence of, because I get to learn so much, because I feel dumb when I'm with them? Because that's, I think, a life goal for everyone who wants to optimize for growth, that you should be the dumbest in the room, not the smartest. So I think that's something at a founder level, those are the things that I actually look for. The product, again, should be scalable, usable, should be solving for a real world need. Should be not 10, 20%, 50% better than any other product that already exists in the market, should be 10x better. Should basically have a sort of, right timing, right market fit. So like, for example, if you compare, let's say, US versus UK versus India, or even China, India and China, the apps that you would see from like a consumer tech perspective are very noisy. The UI UX is like a lot of things are bombarded in your face. While if you look at the US, it's the total opposite, and UK is somewhere in the middle, right? So it just basically is like, do you know the product that needs to build for your market? This is just a standard example for consumer tech, but like same can be, extrapolated for B2B and other industries as well. And then business model, the very basic question at seed is like, do you think you will ever make money? And if yes, how? That's all I need to know. I don't need you to have traction, but like, yeah, are you thinking of monetizing, or is this just gonna be like a lifestyle hobby or like a researchy kind of business that you're thinking of doing? And then finally, market. Who are the other players? What are you disrupting? The macroeconomic situation, so on and so forth. So I think the FPBM framework in my mind has been there for like several years now, and it still suits me well. But I will also actually supplement this by sharing a story as to why I think this framework is still not 100%. So there's the story of chicken sexers. This village in China basically did this sort of research, like this university in the US did this research project in this village where they took under 7-year-old kids from a school and they took them out to the farms. And every day for 3 months, the teacher would tell them to pick up a chicken, look at the genitalia, and segregate into male and female. The teacher basically did this to check the cognitive capability of the student. But what happened was, in less than 3 months, the student is able to look at the face of a chicken, baby chicken. These are baby chickens, they're all identical. They could look at a face of a baby chicken and segregate into male and female with 99.8% accuracy. So there's a scientific basis for gut feeling. And sometimes when my framework doesn't work, I feel it in my gut. I feel this is someone exceptional and I still need to work with them, even if their product idea is shit. And trust me, a lot of product ideas at early stage are shit. Even if there's no clarity of business model, even if the market is wrong, I feel this is someone exceptional. And there's that feeling in my gut, and then I would invest. So I would say that is less than 5% of cases. 90, 95% of the time, the framework truly works. But like those outlier founders that you meet who are like missionaries or they're mercenaries, they are truly someone that you feel there's something there. Their first business could fail, but their second business could be a $10 billion company. So you want to work with this person over the next 10 to 15 years. And that's how I basically sort of sometimes invest as well. So I know it's a very conflicting answer, but that's just how I think my mental model works.
Not at all. I would say this is pretty accurate. Like, you covered all the bases. You didn't just give a book answer or something that you like said worked 95% of the times. I think that answer on 5%, honestly, is probably what will return the fund for you anyways.
Exactly.
So I think it was lovely. I think it was well covered and you were comprehensive. So thank you for that. The last
Thank
one
you.
that we love to ask our guests, and specifically why we run this show in the first place, you are clearly one of the leading voices as a woman in the VC ecosystem, and in a very short time, you've created a name for yourself. Talk to us on what advice would you have for aspiring female investors, who are looking to transition into this space and grow up in the ladder.
Absolutely. So I actually do a lot of mentorship work on the side, whatever time I have left after like the busy schedule you have as an investor. I always say three things that, by the way, it didn't work for me because I didn't know them when I was starting out. But retrospectively, hindsight is always 20/20. So these are three things that I would focus on. One is know your why and acknowledge it. So why do you want to do investing? Is it because, hey, I went to a fancy university and I want to make money? I get it. Just know it, acknowledge it, embrace it. Is it because you were working in nonprofits and you felt that the philanthropic impact is nowhere close to tech impact, which was basically my, just acknowledge it and be honest about it. Like the problem with that, I mean, it sounds like a fancy answer, but the problem with that then becomes I'm very little money-minded, which is a very bad quality as an investor. So that is something I know and I'm aware of and I work hard on. And so on and so forth. Just know your why and acknowledge it, embrace it, make it your strength. And by default, you will have some weakness. Be aware of those weaknesses. So that is basically number one step when I'm interviewing for investing roles. This is genuinely one of the first most important questions I answer. And I would say 98% of perfect candidates on paper are not aware of it. So it's very important to know that. Second would be, where are you today? Evaluate yourself. A lot of investment banking and consulting people specifically who try to kind of get into investing, they think, hey, investing is an extrapolation of what they have been doing, extrapolation of looking at annual reports and looking at, like making financial models. The reality is, it depends obviously on the stage of investing that you join. We are a pre-seed to pre-IPO fund. We also write LP checks. So we pretty much do everything. And I run blockchain and co-run AI for all the funds. So like I have to like do context switching and switching hats very often. But at the same time, it's important to know what are the skill sets required. And one of the most important, and I can say this with a lot of confidence, having done all the stages now, is for you to actually know the importance of the sector or the space that you're looking at, as well as what you look at when you back a company. So it could be the earlier you go, the more indexing on the founder happens. The later you go, it could be senior management, it could be market, it could be the attraction, it could be anything. But it's very important to learn those things, which I don't think any space, any profession except for VC teaches you at that level of depth. Getting that subtext basically is something that is very, very hard to do. So just understand where you are and try to figure out how you can get to that level is exceptionally important. And the third is truly optimizing for, so I mean, second would give you a path, right? Like how to kind of get into investing. But the third would be, know where you're going to end up. So like the important thing here is getting into investing and then switching, a lot of people think is easy. It's not. Let me make it very clear. It's not. You think, oh, I'll do this and then I'll do this. After 2 years, I'll go there. That's not how it works. That works as an operator because skills are transferable, but every single investor on the planet, I can say this with confidence, operates very differently. So the model that you learn, so first you'll join investing, you'll learn from your seniors. The model that you learn may or may not even be like a 40% fit at another fund. So it's very important to know the kind of people that you'll work with, the kind of people you'll be in the foxhole with, the kind of people you'll want to learn from, their experience, their credibility. Are they good teachers? Sometimes good practitioners are not good teachers. So like optimizing for all of these things is exceptionally important. Like I said, I was working with multiple headhunters and I had seven offers, not to toot my own horn, that sounds very braggy. But when I was evaluating them, I was very confused and I had created like this very detailed framework that I posted on LinkedIn as well, where basically I talk about sort of all the important things that matter to me, as well as the weightages for each of them. And then I scored all the seven funds and Local Globe came out number one. So just know the importance of where you end up. So like this basically covers where you are today, know your why, outline the path, understand how much work that you need to be doing, and then know where you're going to end up. So this entire sort of three-step journey is, in my opinion, exceptionally important to think of before you even start, let's say, writing a single cold email to a sort of a VC fund or like working with a headhunter. And the more sort of thoughtful and insightful and cognizant of these processes you'd be, the happier you'd be in the role that you end up with.
I love this. I think this is amazing. Very, very detailed for sure. And I'm sure our listeners would appreciate it done. This does give them a very good framework to think through. Thank you so much, Ash. This was a beautiful conversation. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. This was amazing and really insightful questions. So hopefully the audience likes it. Thank you.